So, ladies and gentlemen, I told you before that Johnny Lewis may do the laser panel, and now we know that he will do the laser panel. And therefore, Nigel Harris is talking with Steve Conway, and Steve Conway is talking with Nigel Harris. So have a big welcome for both of them.
You think I'd know that after all this time. It's lovely to see you again, Nigel. We kind of see each other very infrequently over the years.
Yes, it's since we worked together, must be 10 years now. Is it, or more than that now?
That's right. We were together around the time of the relaunch of the satellite service.
That's right. You came back to us then, didn't you, after going back to Ireland for a while?
That's right. And that was a story in itself. But I have to start off by saying I am really, really looking forward to your book.
Because thank you, Steve.
There have been many books by people about Caroline, myself included, but, you know, I went to Caroline and that's all I did. You did so much stuff. Can you tell me about the different things that are in it?
Well, it's a long, trepidatious trip through life. Working on radio ships, as you know, Steve, is a topsy-turvy career in itself. And I did, many years, on the Mi Amigo, starting off initially. I did about 4 years on the ship there, 3 or 4 years. And after, I mean, so many stories to tell about that ship and how she basically started to rot away at sea, and trying to keep her on the air was a difficult task for all those involved. But, I mean, to bring the story down to the nutshell, it was a trip out to the Mi Amigo, which then led to a journey across to, where did I go after that? To Aberdeen. I'll come back to Caroline again, but generally speaking, I went to Aberdeen to work on a station which never made it on the air.
Was this
the Cedar Lee project?
You know, I've heard about that, but I've never got the full story, and that's one of the reasons why I'm particularly looking forward to this book.
That was a short period of activity, if you like, but again, as it's to do with offshore radio, a difficult one, and it was a long way away going up to Aberdeen. That station never made it to the air for a number of reasons. Then it was a trip to a place you know very well, Dublin, for the Radio Paradise saga. Again, the station didn't really make it on the air. I'm beginning to think it was my fault after all these occasions. But that was another station that was, a lot of money in this one. It was a lot of time and effort to re-equip a ship, which we did ourselves in Dublin. We refitted the thing with a crew of hand-picked people, if you like, from various places across Europe. And we were in Dublin for about 6-7 months, I believe. Then again, we went... this one got a little further than the Birchley project. This one actually got to the North Sea and anchored off the Dutch coast and, unfortunately, was raided.
Did it start test
transmissions? It had a week. I vaguely remember. I had a week of test transmissions. Yeah. The tapes were recorded in Dublin from Radio Nova, which was at the time run by Chris Carey.
Yeah,
that was his station. We recorded his output, and that was used as a broadcast test, but only for about 5 days or so, I think. Maybe even less than that before it was raided.
Were you on board when it was raided?
I luckily come off on shore leave.
I was going to say, you really would be unlucky if you were on both the radio ships.
That was right. I came home, and I got a phone call on the Saturday to say the thing had gone. That was the end of that, sadly. And then, of course, came the big one. Ross Revenge arrived on the scene. And as you know, when you first went out there, it's just a sight to behold, isn't it, that ship?
Really, really lovely ship. Now, many of the people I know who've been on both ships, you know, they acknowledge that the Ross Revenge was technically better, but they always seem to have this soft spot for the Mi Amigo. What was your favourite?
Mi Amigo. I mean, as you say quite rightly, Steve, I have a lot of admiration for the Ross Revenge. A lovely ship. It was built for the job, virtually. And where the Ross Revenge ended up being anchored in the Falls Head, as you know better than anybody else, is a nightmare anchorage. The Mi Amigo certainly wouldn't have survived there, I don't think, had she been plonked in that position. But yes, you're right. I do have a soft spot for the Mi Amigo. There was a camaraderie about that place, which I just never really got into the Ross somehow.
The other words I've often heard people describe the Mi Amigo was a warmth and an atmosphere as well.
That's very true, yes. Nicely summed up that. She did. There's something about it. And I don't think it was just because it had a lot of history beforehand. There seemed just to be a warmth about the whole ship. And we love the Ross, I know, but there's just something special about the atmosphere, as you say, the warmth on board the Mi Amigo and the ship itself. The ship itself became a friend. I used to talk to it, sadly.
Did it talk back?
No, he used to tell me where to go. I used to touch the side and say, all right, how you doing? Stay afloat one more day, please.
And I received a subconscious message from the Ross once. This is shortly after the mast had fallen down, and we were in the middle of this very strange period when there was just myself and my brother on air, and it was, you know, breakfast with Chris Kennedy, with Steve Conway reading the news, then midday with Steve Conway, with Chris Kennedy reading the news, and then we finished off with, you know, Chris back again, and me reading the news, and that was it. And I was asleep in my bunk one night, and I hadn't had anything to drink, I'll hasten to add at this point. And I just remember this voice was saying to me, go check the anchor chain, go check the anchor chain. And when I got up that morning, I went, and the link where it dropped over the bow of the ship was worn about two-thirds of the way through. And I've no idea why. I mean, I wasn't in the habit of routinely going and checking the anchor chain. No. But this kind of dream just came to me and told me to do that. And we had a tug out a few weeks later and replaced the
sorted
link.
Sorted it out, yeah. Well, I mean, I go on about how long I've done Caroline and some of the ups and downs I had. But I remember listening to Steve and Peter Phillips on The Breakfast Show in the hurricane. And I was driving through Kent from Herne Bay going home to Sittingbourne, and it was about 3 a.m. Now, you were on the ship at the time. Now, that's an experience I didn't have, being in the hurricane. So feelings about that, as a storm built, how did you feel?
That was amazing. You know, we knew it was rough the night before, but of course, there weren't weather forecasts which were really telling us it was going to be particularly bad. And that's what caught everybody on land, you know, away as well. So I went to bed the night before, being up early for the breakfast show and the news shift. Peter Phillips and myself would always have been in bed like before 9 o'clock. So we didn't really see it build. And Peter Phillips off air is just like he was on air. He's just wonderfully unflappable. And he used to wake me up at 5:30 every morning. And that morning got little on the cabin. Good morning to you, Steve. It's a trifle rough today.
Yes.
And I got up and I went upstairs, and all I could hear was this weird howling, which was we later discovered it was a 110-mile-an-hour wind at the Sandetti Light Vessel, which is not that far away from the Ross Revenge. So we had this 110-mile-an-hour wind, which was moaning through the tower, and it was actually so strong in the tower that it was holding the ship steady, and we were almost steady. We were going up and down on these waves. We weren't really going side to side. And Mike Watts was the engineer on board that particular morning, and he was saying, you know, the stress that this must have been putting onto the tower must have been enormous. And the tower, of course, came down a month later, and nobody knows, of course. You know, we don't have kind of CSI metallurgist people who'll go and look at these things for us. But you have to wonder if the hurricane pre-stressed it for that storm that you went through.
Well, as you say, it must have been a horrendous strain on that mast. I mean, 300 feet, 100 metres of mast in a wind like that has got to cause some problems.
That's it. And the other problem I had that morning was trying to get Peter Phillips to understand that this was, like, really, really big, because he went off and he did his breakfast programme as normal. Completely unflappable. And I went up to the newsroom, and television wouldn't work for some reason. I assumed that our TV reception aerial had blown off the roof. I didn't think for one moment that every single TV transmitter was down. But tuned into Radio 4 and listened to them saying that they were broadcasting from the basement of Broadcasting House using emergency generators. And then they gave advice from the police: unless you work in the emergency services or your job is a critical infrastructure function, don't leave your home, don't go to work today. Every road into London is closed, every rail line is blocked. So I typed this all out, brought it down to the studio, and Peter kind of looks at it and says, are you sure?
Yes.
It came from the BBC.
It must be true. Yes. Yeah, well, as so you say, it was an interesting experience to listen to, let alone be out there. It must have been an absolute nightmare. Because you always fear for the anchor chain. Once the anchor chain goes in a gale of that ferocity, the ship will, naturally enough, turn sideways onto the waves.
That's it. And I think just linking the experience that I had that day and that you had about a month later, when the mast came down, there was a little event that happened that was unknown to any of us at the time, and which really illustrates the difficulties of communication in this kind of clandestine, you know, world of offshore pirate radio. We knew after the hurricane that we would need a team of professional riggers to come out and inspect the mast and check it for damage. And the office on land knew that also, and they made the arrangements for that to happen pretty quickly. And a tender came out about 4 days after the hurricane, and it had this professional rigger on board. The tender operator was not our normal English guy. This was a new guy. He only ever worked for us on this one occasion. And he got cold feet when he got to the ship, and he'd been paid extra to stay alongside for 2 hours so we could go off the air and we could have the mast inspected. But he came and went in about 3 minutes. The people who were coming out, there were a couple of DJs came out on that tender, didn't know that the rigger was the rigger. They thought he was just another guy, part of this guy's crew. The rigger, when he got on shore, broke his ankle that afternoon and went into hospital, forgot to tell the office that the mast hadn't been inspected. Everybody on land thought it had been done. Everybody on the ship, unaware that the rigger had been and gone, assumed that he would be coming out soon. And so that critical month went by. And I think it was about November the 12th when there was another tender. And Kevin Turner was coming out to replace Peter Phillips. And they were talking, and Peter kind of said, why haven't they sent out a rigger? And Kevin said, yes, they did. And then we discovered what had happened, and we were kind of horrified. And we said, well, we'll organize it in a couple of weeks. But a couple of weeks was too long.
Then, yes, and down
so
you came.
Tell me about that night.
Well, that night, it was a slow build-up of bad weather. For a couple of days, it was unpleasant on board. And one particular afternoon, I was doing the afternoon show, looking through the window out to sea and seeing boats heading for home. Fishing boats were pulling up the nets. We had a couple close to us for a couple of days, and they headed back to port. And we knew, as you say, you get these weather forecasts, you think, oh, we're in for a bumpy weekend or whatever, and you think no more about it. Business goes on. And the running of the station went on. The storm was a difficult one for dinner because we had to get the ship was rolling all over the place, so we had to get this little
the little wooden slats on
the table
that stopped the plates sliding from one side of the table to the other
and into your lap.
Yeah.
So they were out, so we left them there for the next couple of days. Well, we thought we'd have to leave them there for a couple of days. It was about 9-10 o'clock at night. The storm really got quite ferocious, and by this time, in the mess room, there was a large settee, a large sofa against one wall. That, including the three occupants of it, was lifted and thrown right across the mess room into the dining table. So that's how far she was.
That's really interesting, because that happened on the night of the Goodwin Sands as well.
Did it, yeah.
Yeah, so, and again, that was third week in November, fierce northeasterly, probably same weather system, kind of, you know, cyclically, for all we know.
What we should have known is every time the settee flies across the room, we're going to get some serious trouble. We never saw that coming.
And how come you were videoing at the time?
Purely because of that chair episode. I thought in years to come, when I'm sitting at home in my rocking chair, it'd be quite funny to look back on. So I went down to the cabin, grabbed the video camera, and went up to the record library where everyone had started to gather. And it was just at that moment, as the ship was flying around, that we heard this slow build-up. She'd gone off the air already. The station had gone off an hour or two earlier. One of the feeder cables had come loose at the top, and it was flicking around all over the place, arcing badly, so Peter Chicago turned the transmitters off. So it wasn't actually the mast coming down that took us off the air. That had already happened. And it was just a slow, it's like dropping some cutlery in the kitchen. Just heard this little chink of metalwork. And if you've seen the video, you can hear Tim Allen say, what the was that? And you can hear my squeaky voice go, oh, don't worry, it's something on the bridge. And it was the mast coming down. And then bit by bit, the clattering and the clamoring of the metalwork starts to increase, and you can hear the pings of all the stays slapping, and huge great metal ropes are banging into the side of the ship along the side of the bridge. And it just built and built and built in intensity, this crashing of metalwork. And that's scary enough, but of course the alarm bells start to ring as Peter Chicago's pressed the alarm bells on the bridge. So there's this huge great drill, and it was one continuous ring.
It's death and disaster.
One ring is tender or something, another ring is dinner. Yeah. The third continuous ring means you're in trouble. So we all went down to the deck level, if you like, inside the ship, where our Captain Ernie was trying to gather us and keep us calm, actually. And it's life jackets on for everybody. And almost immediately you could feel that the ship had taken on a new being. The center of gravity had got changed without the mast, because she had 200 tons of concrete in the hold, I believe.
That's right.
To counterbalance the weight of the mast.
And I was talking to Keith Francis recently, who was with you that night.
Yeah.
And Keith was saying to me, he stood there, you were all lined up apparently in the corridor with your checking your life jackets. Mm. He said he was there thinking, I don't want to die. I don't want to die.
Yes.
How did you feel?
It was a fleeting feeling that the ship might go over. But I think the man that saved the situation was our Captain Ernie, who in his calm voice, but forceful voice, I should say, was telling everybody that he'd been on rougher rides than this on that ship. He used to be a chief engineer.
That's right.
When it was a fishing boat, so he knew the Ross Revenge inside out. But he then added that we were not to worry. If she turned over, she'd come back up again and right herself like a self-righting lifeboat. And that filled me with horror, the thought of that thing going under and then coming back again. It was a ride that I didn't want to take. But you're right, Steve, just for a fleeting second, I think we all thought that was it. That was it. And you know all about that, because years later you had a far worse experience than that. So
we had a similar thing, which we'll probably come to in a bit. But again, just illustrating that the communication gap was always the hardest thing, because I had gone on shore leave at the time, and Cosmic, who had been doing the running around and organising the tenders for us up to that point, had gone away for a week. And Ronan had asked me to stand in. And I was woken up the following morning because Peter Moore had heard a news report on Invicta, and the Invicta news report actually said the main transmitter is hanging by a string. You think a radio station would actually know the difference between a transmitter and a mast.
That's what we thought. So
we knew something had happened to the mast, and we couldn't get in touch with the ship. There was a private radio link that was used in emergency, which had a little aerial about a third of the way up the mast, and it wasn't working. So we knew something was up, and we had to wait the whole day till 5:45 when there was a CB contact with the ship. And that whole day we're going, how much is left? How much is left? Is there enough to work with? What can we do? And we got a message at about 6:15 from the guy who did the CB contact, and he said, 3 inches.
Yeah, that's all there was. I think everyone on land at the time were obviously hoping, but suspecting it was a top section. Had as so often happened on radio ships, the Mi Amigo lost a tiny bit at the top. I mean, lost loads of mast in the early days, but the final one on the Mi Amigo, I think, had lost a top section. And that had landed on the deck and then was welded to the deck house and used to put the TV aerial on the top. So it was used right to the end. That was a good thing. Didn't go in the sea. But no, the story about the 300-footer coming down, you could see the mast had twisted as she came down. Do you remember the three corners that were left were just twisted round, and the tire virtually spun on its axis before collapsing in a heap. And most of it went over the side, but a lot of it was still being held by the stays. And early in the morning, on the night the mast came down, we weren't allowed on the deck. Peter Chicago and the captain went out with oxyacetylene and burnt it away.
Yeah. And that's a dangerous job, because you can be killed by stays snapping under pressure.
Absolutely, as they went. I've still got a mark, actually. I'll show it to you. There you are. When we were throwing the bits over the bits of the insulator, the porcelain, over the side, which was the part where the feeder went up the tower, there were huge great chunks of it lying around the deck. And if there's trouble, I'll always walk into it. I'll get I put my foot in it, and as we lifted it over the side, it flicked back, and it tore my wrist open. And Chicago was walking past, and he was going, Pshoo! I said, Peter, and he almost fainted because he can't stand the sight of blood. And I wasn't enjoying this very much, but luckily we had a chap out there, Tony Peters at the time, who used to work in the mortuary of a hospital. So he came up and sorted me out.
I was going to say, at least you knew you would be looked after if the worst came to the worst.
If the worst came to the worst, I was in good hands.
And you stayed on with Caroline then, as I did myself, and you, both of us, we kind of came and went, and you were back again in the autumn of 1988, a year later, and I remember something which I have actually said in my book. There is a particular lineup that we had that autumn, kind of November into December, which I describe as the strongest presenter lineup that we ever had during the time that I was in charge, and you were one of it. So.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you very much.
I have to say, it's very interesting. I'm looking forward to reading your comments on that era, because I think if you put 10 people into a room, you know, who had worked on Radio Caroline and made them write 10 books, they would all be different.
Absolutely, yes.
Everybody has a kind of a different take on things. And also, just like the first time you ever hear your own voice in a microphone, it's not what you think it looks like. To see yourself as described in other people's eyes, kind of, it's always interesting. So I don't know what you've written about me, but I forgive you for all of it. Because
well, it's very kind. Nothing horrible about anybody. Well, there's a couple of bits, but that's going back years and years and years.
Well, I mean, whatever you've written won't be as bad as the truth. Put it that way.
It's true. I'll have to start another book. Most of the Ships in Troubled Waters is actually based on the Mi Amigo days. That's good. I guess over half the books on the ship there. I thought... and I know of Steve's book, brilliant book, by the way. I know Steve had covered a lot of what I was going to get to in a lot of detail. A lot of it I wasn't there for. So rather than write about the time I wasn't there from a listener's perspective, I've kind of not glossed over it, but it just tells a story more of my Mi Amigo days and the two other ships, the Paradise and Seedley Business, and then the Ross. My days on the Ross were... was 84, I think. Then there was a gap up to about 87.
That's right.
And then I did 87, 88, and by then 89, and it was starting to get into difficulty by then.
I kind of always feel the mast going over was the defining point, because up until then, the ship got better and better, signaled stronger and stronger, and more equipment. Mm. And from that moment onwards, it was always a struggle. We always recovered from each disaster, but then the next disaster would leave us that little bit lower.
Yeah.
I have a fabulous recording of you, by the way, and just to balance this, so that I don't embarrass you without embarrassing yourself, myself, I also have an equally fabulous recording of myself saying something really stupid. But the recording of you, it's the 1st of January 1989, and you're doing a program, and you just say, "Do you know what? I can feel it in my bones. 1989 is going to be a great year for Radio Caroline."
It was for about a week.
But to balance that, I also have a recording of myself about 2 days after we got the very ill-fated fiberglass antenna up and running in its full glory, all 100 foot or so of it. And we were rebroadcasting 558 on 819 for 4 or 5 days before the Dutch started testing. And the thing only lasted about 11 days, I think, before it fell over. And this first morning of test transmissions, I'm saying, we're firing on all transmitters now. And here's a song that I think is appropriate. And I played Starship, Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now.
And then bang.
That's it, exactly. You should never try to predict. Actually, I learned a really useful lesson from Caroline, which I've applied in my life kind of since then. And that is, we had the ship out there. And we had a 50 kilowatt transmitter on it, and we had a kind of a 10-ish kilowatt transmitter, two nice frequencies. And more often than not, come 1 o'clock in the morning, we used to turn those transmitters off and go to bed. And people would kill these days for 50 kilowatts of medium wave on a good frequency, even covering 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. And it made me realize afterwards, after it was gone and after we lost it, take what you have now and use it. Use every single drop of it. And when I went to work for a pirate station in Dublin called Phantom on FM, and the whole time that it was there, I was always conscious of the fact that it could be gone any day. And I put kind of my utmost effort into it, and I always felt that if anything happened, and if we didn't get the license, which we eventually did get, that I could feel satisfied that I'd made the maximum effort. But I learned that from Caroline. I learned that from sitting and thinking afterwards about that 50 kilowatt transmitter switched off for 4 hours a night.
It's funny being on the ship. I don't think any of us actually sat down and thought, what's going to happen when it all ends? We all knew it would, I guess, deep down. But I remember sitting there thinking, well, it can't really. This is Radio Caroline. This will go on in some shape or form. And I think getting a new ship in 83, I always imagined we get another one. There might be a gap of several years, but there'll all be something coming on. But as we know, not the case. Now, talking about transmitter powers, I remember once on the Mi Amigo, Peter Chicago came into the mess room and he announced that after 9 o'clock, we would be broadcasting on low power, 30 kilowatts.
Wow.
And there was this great big, oh, but I'm on the air at 9, I don't want to go on low power. 30 kilowatts. As you say today, you just be grateful for everything you've got.
I know you're kind of grateful to get 50 watts on something from Latvia for half an hour on a Wednesday. So
well, it comes down to those wonderful powers allotted by Ofcom for AM broadcast. 1 watt.
That's it. We actually, I have to say, we have a much more enlightened system in Ireland. A temporary licensed station is allowed 5 kilowatts. Provided it doesn't carry advertising. And given that most RSL stations have a job selling advertising anyway, it's actually very good. So you can have when Phantom, in between being a pirate and being a licensed station, went through a temporary licensed phase, we were allowed 5 kilowatts on a mountain site, and we got all the way up across the border into Northern Ireland, and we hit Newry. I really wish that the RSL system in the UK could do that.
Yes, that would be quite an improvement. But anyway, moving on to, let's say, what have we done? We've done the Hurricane, the Mast. Well, we touch on the Raid, and then we'll go on to the Goodwin Sands, I think, now. So you were in Ireland in the Raid. You'd gone back to Dublin, I believe.
I'd come off the ship for a couple of years, actually. And after it had come to an end transmission-wise, I made a fatal mistake. I went into the Black Rose pub in Highgate one Saturday, only intending to just drop in, say hello to Peter Moore. Ronan was there, and he just set to work on me. And he could be immensely persuasive. Really, that guy, he could just get you to do anything. And by the end of the conversation, I was quitting my job. I was going back out to the ship, and I was going to be part of the crew who were babysitting it in international waters, because the good times were just around the corner. So I went back out, and it was in a terrible state. It had really decayed, particularly a radio ship with no money coming in at all. To tell you this little story in case we get cut off time-wise. When we did run aground, one of the things the Coast Guard always ask you, they have to alert the pollution control authorities. So they ask you, how many tons of diesel do you have on board? And we came back and said, well, we actually have 50 litres. And they said, no, you mean you have 50 tonnes? And we said, no, we actually have 50 litres of diesel, and that is the only fuel on the ship. And we were running this little generator that used, like, tiny, tiny amount, but we would have run out, like, 4 or 5 days later anyway.
Yeah.
So we couldn't start the main engine, even if there was anybody who knew how, and there was only a couple of DJs and a newsreader left, so we didn't know how. The rudder had a problem, so if we could have started the engine, we couldn't have steered it. And the visibility was so bad that we were onto the Goodwin Sands before we really realized it. To this day, I have to say, and it's not something I've ever admitted in public before, but I still feel guilty about saying to Dover Harbour Board, yes, we will take the tugs. Yes, we will be towed into harbour. It felt like a betrayal. But it felt like it was the only option that we could possibly take. There was no money. There was no magic tug that was going to come from somewhere and re-anchor us. We either took the tugs to Dover or we lost the ship.
Yep. Yeah, I could see how that would play on your mind, but you made the right decisions.
Yeah, it's just a very hard thing to do for Caroline. And when we came to the end, initially they tried to evacuate us at 4 a.m. and we said, no, we're going to stay. We're going to save the ship. Quite how we thought we were going to save the ship, I really don't know. But you know, Neil was gung-ho, and, you know, we followed him, and we said, yeah, we're going to do it. This is Caroline. We never give in. And we tried to kind of keep a level keel on things, and gradually the ship started going over and over. And the horrifying thing was it wasn't trying to come back up again. It was on this sandbank, and it got to about 45 degrees. And then we decided we would abandon ship. And the lifeboat came to rescue us. The lifeboat ran aground, and it was stuck. And at that point, now I think this was kind of a little bit of psychological warfare to get us off. But Dover Harbour Board broadcast, or Dover Coast Guard, broadcast a message to other vessels in the area saying, be prepared to be looking for bodies in the water. And at that point, it was just like, get me the helicopter now, you know?
Yeah, you heard that comment on the
radio. We heard that comment. And eventually the helicopter was coming, and we were still going over. We said goodbye to each other. You know, Neil and myself and the other guys who were there, we shook hands and we said, it's been nice knowing you. We were convinced we were going to be in that water in 4 or 5 minutes' time. And the most poignant thing, I remember this other ship out there, somewhere out in the darkness, another ship heard that message from the Coast Guard about the bodies in the water, and they just sent a little radio message saying, God bless you, Rost Revenge. You were the good guys. And that really choked us, you know, as well. But we survived, and the ship survived to lead another life. So
where was the lifeboat at this point? Stuck to your stern, was it?
It was about 50 yards away. And, I mean, you've got to hand it to the guys in the lifeboat. They really will go into danger. They were washed over. They capsized. Their cox, their captain, was washed off the boat and into the sea. He had a lifeline attached. So they managed to haul him back on. But there was us, you know, us selfish guys who had been playing at running a radio station, thinking, oh, God, we might be in the water. And this guy, actually, who was coming out to rescue us, ended up in the sea in the middle of winter in the Goodwin Sands. And you know, again, one of the things I've been doing since my book came out, I've been doing reading tours of Ireland and raising funds for the RNLI, because I think I kind of owe them. So
that's a nice one. Eventually, off on the helicopter then. That must have been a difficult mission to get you off the deck.
Well, you see, they couldn't come over the ship because the masts were in the way, and the only thing they could do is hover right at the stern and lower a guy down. And we had to get from the bridge to the stern, which would be easy in normal circumstances. But the deck was at a 45-degree angle. These waves were actually coming right over it. And so we actually crawled on our hands and knees down the steps from the bridge wing down to the back deck. And then we dashed for the tower and hung onto that and got washed by a wave. And then dashed for the stays at the back and hung onto those. And these waves, they were blinding us. We were swallowing seawater. We felt like we were half drowned, I think, by the time we eventually got off. And then they took us to RAF Manston, where the police were waiting to interview us, but no charges were pressed.
That's kind of them, isn't it? After all that, in my eyes, you're all heroes, I must say. That must have been a nightmare situation, one I've never actually been through to that degree.
And you were on the Voice of Peace, I remember, at the time, because you actually flew back from Israel either the day that happened or the day after it happened.
I flew back the day it happened. I landed at Gatwick as you were struggling on the sands, and we came into Gatwick, and the wind was so strong, as you know better than I, that night, that we touched down and took off again.
Yeah,
the wheel slipped on the runway, and it suddenly got full power again, and I froze. I mean, you were scared on the North Sea, and I was having this, well, not quite, obviously not dangerous, but I was in fear for my life again as I gripped the woman on one side and the edge of the seat on the other. She had marks around her arm. I didn't even know who she was. As I gripped onto this lady as we landed.
I hope you apologised to her afterwards.
Profusely. But it was a night at Victoria Station. I couldn't get a train home in the morning. Yeah. And I was frog-marched off the platform by the police several times, because you're not allowed to wait inside Victoria Station when the trains aren't running. Got a train home eventually in the morning, and first thing that greets me when I get home is the news on TV. Probably about 7, 8 o'clock in the morning I saw it, and there was the story unfurling right before my eyes.
And, you know, anyone who's been out on any of the ships. You just have it in your blood. You have this love for it. It must have torn you apart, really, to
Well, when
see
I was
that.
I went in I was in Israel on the Voice of Peace for 6-7 months. I'd left England. I'd been to see Peter Moore, filled the car up with grub, food and whatnot, had driven down to Whitstable, and I think one of our tenders took the food out there. It was off the air by then. The caretaker crew were on board. And I flew off to Israel. And I always had it at the back of my mind that Ronan would come up with this famous third world license. I'd come back and just pick up where I left off, but it was not to be. It never happened.
We still had that in our mind even to the day before the big storm. The third world license was going to be our savior. And we were tidying the record library. And in fact, Neil and myself that week had been flushing through and cleansing out the fuel system. Since we only had 50 litres on board, we thought it was the ideal time to flush out the tanks and clean through the lines for the huge deliveries of fuel that were going to be coming to us when Ronan restarted the station. And funnily enough, Johnny Lewis is also involved in this story. Johnny, who'll be up next. The day that that storm was building, of course, we weren't on the air. We had nothing to do but listen to the radio. He was on Invicta Radio that afternoon. And I think he was doing a weather report out of the news, and he went, blah, 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 Invicta Radio, and, you know, and it's going to be northeasterly storm force 10 or 11 tonight. And he just paused, and he said, I know a few people who won't be happy with that.
Yes.
And he was right.
Yeah, absolutely. But there we are. We all live to tell the tale. That's the main thing.
So what would be your favourite moment of all the times that
my entire
spent.
Career, goodness me. There are many. It's funny, as anyone thinks back to any turbulent time. I mean, Caroline's never been smooth. It's had its good days and bad days. Normally, you can look back through rose-tinted glasses, just remember the good times and whatnot. But with Caroline, I can think back and remember all the bad times. There were good times, obviously, a lot of them. But I guess a highlight, I actually wasn't on the boat at the time, but another long period of off the air for Radio Caroline was in 79, when she, I think, was off the air for about 6 months before coming back at Easter in 1979, I believe. And I think with the ship at sea being off the air, it was the same as you had it later, but this time there was no reason why it didn't come back. The laws weren't quite the same in those days.
It was probably
days.
Just money, I guess.
It was money, and it was lack of repairs on generators, general maintenance on the ship. And we got back on the air. And I think for me, having the thing come back on then was almost as exciting as it must have been, hearing it for the first time back in the 60s maybe, or when the Ross launched. That was a highlight. I loved that. Just hearing that. Well, you don't get it these days, but hearing a carrier on medium wave, the warmth of the transmitter, and then suddenly that drum roll as the Fortunes start to sing, and that just wonderful. Then Tony Allen came on the air and relaunched the station, and we went into 1980. The Mi Amigos saw through some horrendous storms at the end of the 70s into the 80s, and we thought, happy days are here again, and we had big plans for a daytime service, fill the ship with fuel, get the anchors checked. Oh, we'll do it in April when the weather gets better. And then March came, and that was the end of that. So, but I think that's probably one of my highlights. What about you, Steve?
There's a particular memory that I have, and apologies to if anyone's already read the book, they kind of know this story, but we had this little inflatable boat, and we went off on a trip one night because the Ullo Line ferry, which used to pass us, had agreed to actually bring us some supplies because we had a really friendly captain. And you were actually on board that night. I think you were on the air at the time, and you watched us go over to the ferry.
Yeah,
and come back. And we went over to the ferry and, you know, in a little rubber boat beside one of those huge ferries, we were kind of looking up miles. And they lowered a bucket on a rope full of today's newspapers, you know, sweets, chocolates, various things. And all the passengers were looking out the window thinking, is this a drug deal or is there something going on here? And we turned around to head back towards the ship. And there was almost a full moon that night. And it was pretty calm, otherwise we wouldn't have been in the little boat. The sea was just this liquid silver, and there, right in the middle of it, was the Ross Revenge, looking beautiful, looking really lovely. And the mast went up, and it pierced the moon in the very centre. And we were all silent. And we looked at this, and we just loved it. You know, that was our home. It was our life. But more than that, it was our dream. And this mast that was sticking up, you know, and touching the moon was sending out this great music, you know, to dozens of cities and probably thousands of towns. And it's just one of those moments that lasted for an eternity, but I'll never forget it. And there's one thing, actually, that I really liked about the boat that rocked, or there were a couple of visual images. There's one visual image that crops up for about 2 seconds in the film of the ship in a pool of moonlight, and that brought me straight back.
The aerial shots.
The aerial shots, yeah.
That's a nice picture. It's a nice shot. I remember that but little boat coming back from the Olo ferry in amongst all the goodies. I never worked out why. Something to do with cooking, I guess. It was a clove of garlic.
Asked for it.
Oh, you'd asked for it, had you?
Yes. I think Jackie was doing the cooking at the time, and she had given a shopping list. And a few days earlier, we had run out of onions, and they had actually come close enough to us to try throwing onions at us. And they almost, like, they were actually hitting the back of the ship and bouncing into the water, but they weren't quite getting onto the back deck. So we had onions as well, but we had sweets at today's newspapers. Kill for today's newspapers.
Absolutely.
Out on the ship. You know, and that's just one of those really good memories.
Yeah, that the isolation was quite a problem at times. It depends who, if you were with a good group of people, it was almost like being away at school. You just have a great time. It's just fun and games all the time. But sometimes, off, as you know, Steve, better than a lot, off the air, long periods, bad weather, tempers get a bit frayed and you can start having difficult times with your colleagues. And weeks, the days are long, so long and boring, and the weeks roll on, you see nothing, no boats come from land, and you just wonder when it's going to end. But suddenly when it does, and you get that contact with land again, all that's forgotten as you get the newspapers. And sometimes we'd get fresh milk on the boat, which is a dream after all that long life stuff that we had to live on for so long. But then it's gone, so that moment is gone.
That's right, and you were on board with me for Christmas 1988, and we hadn't had a supply boat for a long time. And in the end, one turned up at 4 a.m. on Christmas morning. But before that, we thought that all we had saved for Christmas dinner, some rice, some sausages. So it's going to be sausages and rice. And we had saved our last remaining carton of long life UHT milk. And that was going to be our Christmas day.
Yes,
so
yeah, I remember that.
But I'm told, and Johnny Lewis would probably be the guy to ask this, that 84, 85 at one stage, things were so bad, like there were real water shortages. They were emptying the radiators and all sorts of stuff.
Oh, crikey, yes. I can remember people drinking from the radiators. I can remember hardened smokers out there running out of cigarettes and ripping up floorboards, trying to look for dog ends and trying to put sticky tape around them to make something just that long. And that's gone. Then they start the journey again in another part of the ship.
I think Steve Masters tried smoking tea, but it didn't do anything for him.
I remember your brother
yeah.
in the galley on the Ross Revenge. Poor old Chris, he had dreadful toothache. And I walked into the galley. He's leaning on the sink by the taps. He's got a pair of pliers in his mouth. I said, Steve, what are you doing? He said, I can't stand the pain. Chris, what are you doing? Yeah. I can't stand the pain any longer. I've got to get this bloody thing out. And I said, no, Steve, you can't do that. And as I said it, he yanked it. And he snapped
goodness.
The tooth in half. He doubled the pain instantly. Poor fellow.
And actually, just to kind of pay tribute to Chris, he really wanted to be here today, but he wasn't able to make it. He had some other commitments that he couldn't get out of. He was not only a mainstay during the time that I was there and you were there in the late 80s. I have, you know, him to thank for getting me into Caroline in the first place, because he was 4 years older than me, and he discovered Caroline when he was about 12, and he insisted that it was played all over the house. Now, this was in Dublin, and this was in the Mi Amigo days. Mm. He used to position the radios by the copper piping for the radiators. Mm. And I was the only kid in school in Dublin who went into school singing the Susie Waffles jingle.
Yeah, well, that's a great story. Well, I think our time is up, Steve.
That's it. So your book, Ships in Troubled Waters,
yes.
I believe it's available for sale here today.
It will be in a second or two. And yours
is
Shipwrecked.
Shipwrecked, Life on the Waves of Radio Caroline, and it's on sale here too.
Anyone else written the book we can plug? No? Excellent. Well, thank you. I hope you've enjoyed the stories. Bob Noakes has a book. Well done, Bob.
And, of course, Keith Skews.
And Keith Skews has a book. Well, that's four. Let's make it five. No? Do the
station call.
Station call. Oh, yeah, live from the North Sea on 963 kilohertz. It's 2 o'clock, news time with Steve Conway.
And I think in my day it was on 558 kilohertz. This is Radio Caroline. Ding, ding.
That's the one, yeah. And many other frequencies too. Thank you very much.
Thank you.